Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now! President Bush proposes multi-million dollar donation of tax dollars to religious charities. We'll talk with Nation writer Katha Pollitt. And then an extended conversation with Linda Evans. She was granted clemency in the last hours of the Clinton administration. We'll talk about her 16 years in prison. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday, President Bush launched his plan to use government money to support social services run by religious organizations. With a pair of executive orders, he established an office to encourage faith-based groups to seek government funding and ordered five cabinet departments to eliminate regulations making it difficult for them to do so. Civil liberties groups firmly rejected the plan, with Americans United for the Separation of Church and State saying it's creating a new government bureaucracy to funnel tax dollars to religious institutions. The ACLU blasted the plan as a faith-based prescription for discrimination, noting that the program had no provisions for forcing a charity run by a particular religious group to help people of other faiths. We'll have more on that story in just a few minutes. Claiming he was deeply concerned that the California power crisis was spreading beyond the state's borders, President Bush yesterday vowed to make it easier for companies to explore, exploit, and transport oil and gas for the production of more electricity. In a meeting in the Oval Office, which the president described as the first in a series to deepen his involvement in energy issues, Bush named Vice President Dick Cheney to head a task force that he said would devise ways to reduce America's, quote, reliance upon foreign oil and to encourage the development of pipelines and power generating capacity in the country. The task force will work to shepherd through Congress Bush's energy proposals, which include opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and granting waivers to states that seek to run older plants at full capacity, even if that means violating clean air standards. Before joining the Bush ticket, Dick Cheney headed the largest oil services corporation in the world, the Texas-based Halliburton Company. Other appointees to the task force include Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, the former chair of Alcoa, Commerce Secretary Don Evans, the former CEO of the Texas-based oil and gas company Tom Brown, and soon-to-be-confirmed Interior Secretary Gail Norton. Native American activist Leonard Peltier, whose 24-year imprisonment has galvanized human rights activists around the globe, slammed President Clinton yesterday for granting pardons to political supporters, but not to him. Peltier said, "We can see who was granted clemency and why. The big donors to the president's campaign were able to buy justice, something we just couldn't afford," in a statement dictated from his cell in the federal prison in Leavenworth and released by the Leonard Peltier Committee. Peltier went on to say, "What Bill Clinton did to us was cruel. Many political prisoners continue to languish unjustly, proof that this nation's talk about reconciliation is nothing but empty rhetoric." The 56-year-old Peltier says he was framed and wrongly convicted of the murders of two FBI agents in a gun battle in 1975 on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. At the time, the reservation was the site of violent political upheaval, and allegations of FBI and prosecutorial misconduct have dogged the case for years. The list of those calling for Peltier's release includes Amnesty International, former South African President Nelson Mandela, former First Lady of France Danielle Mitterrand, the European, Italian, and Belgian parliaments, the National Council of Churches, and several members of the U.S. Congress. Peltier was one of hundreds of individuals to whom Clinton considered granting clemency and/or pardons in the last days of his administration. Clinton denied Peltier's request while granting other pardons that have raised questions about his motives, most notably his pardon of fugitive billionaire commodities trader Mark Rich. Rich is one of the world's wealthiest people. He was indicted in 1983 on more than 50 counts of wire fraud, racketeering, evading more than $48 million in income taxes and trading with Iran in violation of a U.S. embargo. He fled to Switzerland and has not served jail time for the alleged crimes. Rich's ex-wife, Denise Rich, donated more than $1 million to Bill and Hillary Clinton's political campaigns, as well as the Democratic Party. Clinton also pardoned longtime friend and Whitewater scandal figure Susan McDougal, convicted in connection with an improper loan to pay the debts of a land company in which Clinton and his wife were partners. Peltier's defense committee said yesterday it plans to launch a major campaign to bring public pressure to bear on the U.S. government to declassify about 6,000 FBI documents that pertain to Peltier's case. The Senate yesterday confirmed Elaine Chao as U.S. Labor Secretary. A Taiwanese immigrant with a background in government, business, and charity work, Chao won praise from Republicans and Democrats as the personification of the American dream, winning Senate backing without a single objection. And finally, federal police detained a French activist who led the invasion and occupation of a farm owned by the U.S. agribusiness giant Monsanto and gave him until midnight tonight to leave the country. José Bové, who shot to fame for ransacking a McDonald's restaurant in France, was detained by three plainclothes policemen as he returned to his hotel after addressing the World Social Forum in Brazil, a gathering of opponents of corporate-led globalization.
On your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect, and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Do whatever steps you want if you have cleared them with the pontiff. Everybody say his own, Kyrie eleison, doing the Vatican right. Processional, step into that small confessional. They're the guy who's got religion. I'll tell you if your sin's original. If it is, try playing it safer. Drink the wine and chew the wafer. 2, 4, 6, 8. Time to transubstantiate. So get down upon your knees. Fiddle with your rosaries. Bow your head with great respect and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Make a cross on your abdomen. When in Rome, do like a Roman. Ave Maria. Gee, it's good to see you. Getting ecstatic and sort of dramatic and doing the Vatican rag.
Tom Lehrer singing the Vatican rag here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President George W. Bush has launched his plan to use government money to support social services run by religious organizations. Appearing yesterday with 35 religious leaders, Bush signed an executive order that set up the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. The office will serve as a liaison to religious groups and encourage them to seek government money. Bush also established centers at the Departments of Justice, Education, Labor, Health and Human Services, and Housing and Urban Development to ensure they cooperate with religious and secular nonprofit groups. He ordered these departments to end regulations that could impede the flow of funds. Bush explained, "Everyone knows firsthand there are still deep needs and real suffering in the shadow of America's affluence." He went on to say problems like addiction and abandonment and gang violence, domestic violence, mental illness, and homelessness, and said, "When we see social needs in America, my administration will look first to faith-based programs and community groups." Bush insisted that government would never be replaced by charities, but the question remains, will private religious charities, not bound by anti-discrimination laws and not accountable to an electorate, replace government? We're joined right now by a few people to discuss this issue. First, Katha Pollitt, columnist for The Nation and author of Subject to Debate, Sense and Dissents on Women, Politics, and Culture, her new book, which will soon be released by Modern Library. Your response to Bush's plan?
Oh, hi, Amy. Well, of course, I think it's just the worst possible thing that could happen at this moment. We're going to see, you know, millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, ladled out with no oversight to, you know, all manner of, quote, faith-based organizations. And whatever happened to the term religion, Amy? Now it's all faith, faith, faith. And there's a reason for that. People are suspicious of religion, but they just roll over like a little sick puppy for anything that's called faith. I think it's very troubling because, as you pointed out in your introduction, in the first place, and this is, I think, an understressed point, faith-based or religious organizations do not have to obey labor laws. They can refuse to hire people because of their race, because of their gender, because they belong to the wrong religion, even for the jobs that don't involve religion, like being a janitor. That was actually the test case that went before the Supreme Court, was could a person of a different religion be a janitor in a church if the church didn't want to hire him? No, said the Supreme Court. It's freedom of religion. So you're going to see people, they can refuse to hire people who, say, use contraception, who get divorced, who get remarried, who have children out of wedlock. They can fire people who have children and want to keep on working. Anything goes. And these things have all happened. This is not just some delusion of, you know, mine. Every year there are some people who lose their jobs because of these things. Now the government is saying, fine, here's some more money. The thing about charitable choice, I mean, religious organizations have always been able to bid for government contracts, and that's why we have Catholic Charities, for example, and all kinds of big Protestant and Jewish welfare, social welfare organizations that get tons of money from the government. But this charitable choice is different because what it says is you can get this government money and you can maintain your religious, quote, mission, unquote. So it's already come up. Can you run a homeless shelter and say, okay, you can come into this homeless shelter, but you have to pray? Yes. Now, I think that's shocking. You know, in the great Irish famine, there were Protestant organizations that came over from England and they said, okay, we'll give you some soup, but you have to convert, you know. And the Catholics that converted were called soupers, S-O-U-P-E-R, because they had sold their faith for a bowl of soup. Now, it's not right to put people in that position, I think, and that's what we're going to see.
We're also joined, Katha Pollitt, on the phone by Stephen Lazarus with the Center for Public Justice. He's a social policy research associate there. You have a very different view of the so-called faith-based initiative that Bush unveiled yesterday.
I certainly do, Amy, and I just want to greet Katha and say thanks, and it's an honor to be on with both of you. However, I am really disturbed by a number of points that Katha just made because they, in fact, misrepresent the law. Quite clearly. I mean, the very mistaken observation that charitable choice allows faith-based organizations to discriminate on the basis of race. That's clearly prohibited by the law. I think it's very important before we overreact to this that we pay very close attention to what the law that was passed by Congress, it's been law of the land for 4 years now, to what it allows and what it prohibits. Katha also just mentioned that, or she suggested that faith-based organizations can require participation in religious activities. That's explicitly prohibited by the law. So we need to really base things on the facts here, I think.
Dan Katz is also with us, Director of Legislative Affairs at Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Your response?
Well, I'd like to respond to the last response to clear up a couple of things. In terms of the discrimination, charitable choice, which is what Bush is going to embrace today, explicitly does allow for discrimination based on religion or religious beliefs by the employer. Now, if you look at the Bob Jones University model, you see that the fear of problems like race or sexual orientation bias can be linked to religious beliefs. So in other words, if a tenet of the church has to do with, we do not believe that people of a certain race are equal to us, or they believe that gay Americans do not have equal rights, they can then cite the religious exemption and use that. On another point, where your guest said it's been the law of the land for 4 years, I think that's a good example of why this doesn't work. This has been in the welfare bill for 4 years. The welfare bill passed in 1996. It's been the law for 4 years, and it's been barely used. And the reason it's been barely used is because it's a debacle. If churches do not want to become an arm of the government, they do not want to have their internal records audited, they do not want to have their operations turned into some form of bureaucracy. Now, your guest also said that the law explicitly says that beneficiaries of programs would not be required to engage in worship or be subject to proselytization. The law can say that all it wants, but everyone knows that the real test is enforcement of that. And what are we going to do? Are we going to send federal law enforcement officers into churches to monitor how they're conducting these programs? No one wants that, and that's totally unrealistic. So we're talking about blurring the lines with a law like charitable choice with supposed protections that are going to be impossible to enforce.
Stephen Lazarus.
Well, I think people on the left especially should really support charitable choice because at its basis, what it does is it says that government cannot discriminate between secular and faith-based organizations when it buys services like job training, mentoring, a whole range of services that people in our inner cities and in our other areas that are impoverished need. That is a violation of the separation of church and state for government to take sides in religious, but really privileging religious communities over another. And what charitable choice says is this has to be open to all. In that sense, I think charitable choice is not only constitutionally permissible, it's constitutionally required. And there's some very strong safeguards in the law. No one has to attend a faith-based organization. Government has the responsibility. It's stated right there in the law. And this is a law, of course, that's, supported by Joe Lieberman, by Ted Kennedy. I mean, I'm amazed that this is the one thing that actually supports, Ted Kennedy or actually unites Ted Kennedy and John Ashcroft. I mean, when Ashcroft is leaving the Senate, Kennedy writes him a letter and says, thanks for teaching us something about charitable choice. So we need to look beneath the surface here. But, back to the safeguards.
Let me ask Katha Pollitt what you think of that unity of Kennedy and Ashcroft on this issue.
Well, I think we've seen in the hearings, on the Ashcroft hearings, how much, good fellowship and bonhomie and good old boys sticking together there is. I think it's amazing that Ted Kennedy has roused himself to be as much in opposition to Ashcroft now as he is. But he certainly didn't start out that way. I think Ashcroft's behavior in the committee room is roused some more opposition than there would otherwise have been. But, I think that certainly all throughout the Senate, throughout Congress, on whatever party people are in, they all love religion. They all have to stick together. It was Joe Lieberman, for example, who said all that stuff about how you had to be, people who were religious were better people than people who were not.
Katha Pollitt,
common belief.
Even though we're talking about religion now, how does this move fit in with the growing trend to privatize such formerly government arenas as prisons, schools, Social Security, even welfare?
Well, I think that's really the name of the game. I think that we are moving from the concept where you have a right as a citizen or even as a non-citizen, to certain kinds of help and certain kinds of services. We're moving from that model to a model where it's all charity. If you're the deserving poor, you get it. If you're not the deserving poor, you don't. Let's remember where the term compassionate conservatism came from. It came from Marvin Olasky, best friend of Arianna Huffington, who was the big advocate saying, government programs are a big flop and we should go back to the 19th century. He says this. When religious programs worked a spiritual transformation in people and that made them more deserving and more better citizens.
I really have to take issue with that because my organization, the Center for Public Justice, would certainly not be involved in this, nor would Kennedy or Lieberman be supporting this if this was all about privatization. If we take a look at what charitable choice is, it's a specific set of what Al Gore called carefully tailored guidelines that government has to use when it works with faith-based organizations because the guidelines put specific protections in place for the people that receive services and specific protections in place for faith-based organizations. Remember, these are guidelines for government to use when it spends its money with states. And, it gives money to states to provide community services. So this isn't about privatization at all.
Well, I think it's absolutely about privatization.
Dan Katz of Americans United for Separation Church and State.
I think Ms. Pollitt was absolutely right because I happened to be closely monitoring the 1996 welfare bill at the time. And all the backers of charitable choice were the same exact people who wanted to dismantle the current social service system, to dismantle the existing safety net and wanted to block rent everything to the states and privatize everything was the next step. And it was actually a beautiful device that came up with the charitable choice, because not only did they get to privatize these services, they also got to shift it to pervasively sectarian institutions that can then seek to waive the civil rights protections that normally come with these social services. And, you know, going back to what we talked about before with Senator Kennedy, I have to say, my dealings with Senator Kennedy, he has not embraced charitable choice. He might have said some niceties to Senator Ashcroft upon his exit from the Senate, but the time Senator Kennedy had to go along with charitable choice, it was a take-it-or-leave-it proposition from his Republican colleagues. He said, look, if you want to pass the substance abuse funding and authorization bill for this year, then you're going to have to eat this. And he went ahead and had to accept it because there was nothing else to do. But in terms of whether he embraced and would support charitable choice, I strongly contest that.
Will, can I jump in here?
We have just 1 minute to go.
Well, I just want to say that, you know, before people say, oh, it's so great that religion gets these powers, just think about what religion advocates. Do you want the Southern Baptists, who have an official doctrine that women should be submissive to their husbands, to be running some domestic violence shelter? I don't.
Well, on that note and with that question, we wrap up this discussion, an issue we will continue, of course, to pursue. Our guest, Katha Pollitt, her book is coming out soon. It's called Subject to Debate, Sense and Dissents on Women, Politics, and Culture. Dan Katz of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and Stephen Lazarus of the Center for Public Justice, which is based in Baltimore. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, an extended conversation with Linda Evans. Her sentence was commuted by President Clinton in the last hours of his presidency. We'll talk to her in Oakland, California. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Although President Clinton granted many of his end-of-term pardons, commutations, executive clemencies to cronies and campaign contributors, he failed to grant executive clemency to Leonard Peltier. He did commute the sentences of two of America's many political prisoners, Susan Rosenberg and Linda Evans. Last week, we talked to Rosenberg. Today, we turn to Linda Evans. She was arrested in 1985. The Cold War was in full swing as America launched proxy armies or its own troops throughout Central America and Grenada, often circumventing congressional oversight and U.S. law. This was during the Reagan-Bush years. After opposing the U.S. war in Southeast Asia, Linda Evans had continued her solidarity work in support of liberation movements around the world and turned to armed struggle. With a felony conviction for anti-Vietnam War protest on her record, her arrest for the purchase of guns with a false ID drew a 40-year sentence. She then pled guilty to conspiracy to bomb a U.S. Capitol building in which no one was injured. For the last 16 years, Susan Evans has been in jail. And we're now going to turn to her. Linda Evans has been in jail. she spent most of the time at the Dublin Federal Correctional Institute in California, just outside of Oakland. We talked about her time in prison, her activism before, after, the lessons she learned, and what she plans to do today. And we're going to spend the rest of the program speaking with Linda, as well as her attorney, Debbie Katz. We spoke last night. From Oakland, California, welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy. Thank you so much.
Well, I understand you just went on your first grocery shopping trip in 16 years. How was it?
It was quite confusing, very overwhelming, and an exercise in staying focused.
Have you tasted things outside of prison that you haven't had in 16 years?
Yes, my friends have been feeding me quite regularly, and I have to admit that each meal takes about 2 hours or more to eat because I'm savoring every single leaf of lettuce.
Linda, can you tell us how you ended up in prison?
I became a political activist starting in the period of the civil rights movement, and actually it was at Michigan State University that I first joined any kind of opposition to the established order when the black students demonstrated and sat in demanding a black studies department, more black professors, and open admissions to the university. After that, I went to Detroit, and I was really emotionally moved by the situation in the black community and the contrast between my life and the future that my parents had plotted out for me, and the conditions in the black community moved me to try to oppose racism and to really fight for some kind of equality in our society. And it was also the era of the Vietnam War, and I had joined SDS and was sent as a representative of the youth movement to Vietnam in 1967 to bring back three or four prisoners of war that the Vietnamese were releasing in a gesture of friendship to the American people. I think those two times in my life really changed me a lot, and going to Vietnam made me understand that people who are waging a war for national liberation do not necessarily become violent just because they use violence. And it was quite a lesson, because the Vietnamese people were some of the most gentle, warm people I had ever met in my life. So I came back from Vietnam, and I was a part of the Weather Underground for a minute. I was a participant and a planner of the Days of Rage in 1969, which was an action against racism and against the war in Vietnam in Chicago. And I was indicted, and because the FBI had used illegal wiretaps against us, all those charges ended up being dropped. So eventually I moved to Austin, Texas, and became a political activist in the community there, working with the Black Citizens Task Force and the Brown Berets. And we did a lot of work against the Klan and basically supported national liberation struggles in Nicaragua, all of Central America, worked against apartheid in South Africa. And I became dissatisfied with the level of militance and frustrated, and decided to participate in armed struggle. So I went underground and started operating in clandestinity with other people. And eventually, we were arrested and charged with a number of different actions. I personally had five trials, and some were for harboring a fugitive, my comrade Marilyn Buck, and the weapons charges that you mentioned, Amy, were in Louisiana, and that was a false, I was convicted of making false statements to buy four otherwise legal guns. They were, really what I did was use a false name, and for that I got a 40-year sentence. Of course, most people get, well, 50% of the people that are convicted of that charge get probation, and the other 50% get less than 2 years, so it was quite an extraordinary sentence. Then in 1987, 1988, I was indicted with five other people in the resistance conspiracy case in Washington, D.C. And as Susan probably mentioned, that was a conspiracy to protest and change U.S. government policies and practices, both international and domestic, through violent and illegal means. And it was a conspiracy to do some bombings that were basically symbolic. They were aimed at property destruction, trying to bring attention, public attention, to U.S. policies around apartheid and support for Israel, around police brutality, intervention in Central America, and other issues that we felt U.S. policy was genocidal and criminal. I was arrested for that on May 11th, 1985, my birthday.
And what specifically were you charged with?
I was charged with harboring a fugitive, having a weapon with me when I was arrested. The weapons charges in Louisiana, which were several counts of making false statements, and then the conspiracy charge in D.C., and one count of bombing the U.S. Capitol in support, well, to protest the invasion of Grenada by U.S. forces.
Mm-hmm. What actually happened in that bombing?
As far as I know, there was some minor damage to a painting and to a hallway outside of Strom Thurmond's office. That's what I saw on TV.
And did you accept blame for that bombing? Did you plead guilty?
Yes, I did. The reason that we accepted a plea at that point in time was because our comrade, Alan Berkman, who was one of the six of us, was dying of Hodgkin's disease. Luckily, he survived, and he's again fighting cancer. Susan Rosenberg and Tim Blunk also had charges dropped against them, so I pleaded guilty to being part of the conspiracy that undertook that bombing.
But why did you plead guilty?
We wanted the charges dropped against three of us. You know, there were legal technicalities involved, and also Alan's health was really paramount. So we felt that it was the right thing to do.
So you got 40 years for using a false name to buy guns, and then what did you get for the U.S. Capitol bombing?
I ended up with a 5-year sentence for the conspiracy and the actual act running concurrent, so I received a total of 5 years for that.
And so you went to jail for 16 years, sentenced to 45?
Yes, it was actually altogether 40 because I won an appeal. I knocked off some of it.
Tell us about your time in prison. We're talking to Linda Sue Evans, who had her sentence commuted on inauguration weekend in the last hours of the Clinton administration. She, along with sister activist Susan Rosenberg, who we spoke to last week. Where did you first go in prison, and what did you do, and what did you think about the actions that you brought that had brought you to prison?
Well, I served time because of all the different cases that I had. I was in many, many prisons, and I guess I started out in New York, and I did a lot of time in New Orleans where the Louisiana charges were. I did the bulk of my sentence at FCI Dublin out here, about 40 miles east of Oakland. And I really learned a lot in prison because I understood much better what prison conditions are like and how they dehumanize the people that are imprisoned and what the real purpose is as far as, particularly for women, trying to take away any kind of dignity, any kind of empowerment that we may have developed over our lifetimes. And I also viewed imprisoning the women, and I experienced this because most of them women are mothers, of course, as a direct attack against the generations to come. So in that way, it's really genocidal in its essence. I did a lot of work as an AIDS activist inside. We had an organization called Pleasanton AIDS Counseling and Education, PLACE. We did walkathons and raised money for service organizations in the community outside. We did a lot of AIDS education and support for women who were HIV positive and also for women who had family members who were HIV positive. The institution that I was in has gone the way of most prisons and certainly most federal prisons in that they have now stopped practically all the volunteers from coming in. The organization PLACE was outlawed in 1997, and we were no longer allowed to do AIDS education in any form. So that was a tremendous loss for the population of the prison.
As you were in prison, the prison population in the United States topped 2 million, the largest prison population in the world. What kind of awareness of that is there inside?
Well, most of the women inside have other family members in prison. Of course, in the federal system, approximately a third of the women, certainly in FCI Dublin, were from other countries. So I think there's an awareness that the United States is trying to be the policeman of the world, and there certainly is an awareness of the brutality of the criminal justice system here. I think people inside really understand what it means that more and more people are being imprisoned, and also that people are being driven to economic crimes in order to survive. So it affects them and their families very intensely, and of course a lot of the Americans who are in prison are Black and Latino.
We're also joined by Linda Sue Evans' attorney, Debbie Katz. How did you manage to get the commutation, Debbie Katz?
Well, we're still not sure of all the factors, but I think that in Linda's case, the disproportionality of her sentence and the parole board's abject refusal to let her out, even though she far exceeded her parole guidelines and deserved by any objective measure to get out, I think were issues that really the Clinton Pardon Council really took seriously and understood the great disproportionality of the sentence. But in Linda's case, her release was also supported by the judge who had sentenced her in New Orleans, which was extremely unusual. He supported both her parole, and when Linda was turned down for parole, he then supported her pardon. And one of the prosecutors, who was also familiar with the evidence, supported her as well. So those were factors that certainly suggested she should get a pardon here. Why Clinton did it, it's anybody's guess. I think he really shined as the president in his last 2 hours in office. we're very, very lucky.
Linda Sue Evans, where were you when you heard that the president had commuted your sentence and you would be free?
I had woken up slightly later than usual. It was about 8 o'clock. And I thought to myself, well, he has one more hour, and really I can do the rest of this time, however much it is. I'll just endure it. And I called my girlfriend on the phone, as I do every morning, to say good morning. And she told me I was coming home from prison that day. And that's how I found out. The institution did not even know. As I was speaking with Eve, Debbie Katz was on the phone to the institution trying to convince them that they had to let me go because I had had my sentence commuted by the president.
It was actually quite funny. It was like a catch-22. The institution, of course, had no policies for how to release somebody who gets a presidential commutation. And we were told that because a new administration had just come in, there were no regulations that would tell them what to do. So, of course, we kicked and screamed, and she was let out a few hours later. It was really remarkable.
What were the first things you wanted to do, Linda?
Well, I walked around the block. That was really an amazing experience. I came home to Oakland and just walked around the block with a friend of mine. I wanted to tell everyone that I had just been released from prison, and he managed to hold me in check for that hour. But since then, I have steadily been telling everybody because I act so strangely. It takes me a long time to eat my meals, and I have to, you know, the first time I touched money was quite a different experience, and I acted strange, and the woman that I was, the clerk that I was buying a hair pick from, said, you know, what did you say? I said, well, do you want this story? And she was really quite moved, as was her coworker, who had family members in prison. Everybody has been really happy for me.
As you reflect on your activism and on your belief that violence was a way to combat violence, what are your thoughts today?
I feel even more strongly than ever that we have to build a resistance movement that is creative, that includes many people from many, many different walks of life as possible, that we have to value every single person's contribution, whatever level of resistance they can manage to include in their life, because I think that under this new administration, we're really in trouble. And certainly prisoners are really in trouble because we know Bush is a serial killer, and we know that he is going to reinstitute or begin the federal executions. We know that prison conditions are going to get worse and worse, and unfortunately, we also know that he's not going to pardon or release any of the over 100 political prisoners who are in prison, including Leonard Peltier. I feel very strongly that we need to mobilize to support those prisoners and to try to change conditions in prison and to really make connections internationally with all the movements in various countries that are facing the same type of crises that we're facing in our communities because the economy is being restructured. One thing I've really noticed here in Oakland is the level of homelessness. And, I mean, there's homeless people everywhere, and it's really very sad. Although here they are organized to some extent. They do have a street newspaper that vendors sell. It's exactly the same situation that is happening in many other countries where there are refugees by the millions because peasants have been forced off their land.
We're talking to Linda Evans. Her sentence was just commuted by President Clinton this past weekend on Inauguration Day, a few hours before his administration was over. She was among more than 170 people whose sentences were commuted, who were granted executive clemency, or who got pardoned. She came out of prison on Saturday. We'll continue the conversation with her and her attorney, Debbie Katz, when we come back here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation with Linda Evans and her attorney, Debbie Katz. Linda Evans, who served 16 years in prison, she was at the Dublin Federal Correctional Institute for years outside of Oakland, California. She was convicted for using a false name in getting weapons and also for conspiracy to commit a bombing of a U.S. Capitol building. She was sentenced to more than 40 years in prison. Again, this past weekend, President Clinton commuted her sentence, and she was released on Saturday, as we continue the conversation with Linda Evans. While you were in prison, Linda Evans, how did you get information?
I was very fortunate because I had a very broad circle of support. Being in the Bay Area, I was lucky enough to have a lot of visitors, and they would send me magazines, books, newspapers. I got all kinds of alternative papers from different cities. I watched the news. I listened to KPFA, and I really appreciated the alternative radio and alternative media that I was able to listen to. We couldn't get WBAI out here, but I listened. I was a fan of yours, Amy, and a fan of Democracy Now!, and I really appreciate the efforts that you make to get the word out. I did hear your interview with President Clinton. I admired how you thought on your feet and your commitment to asking him about Leonard. I truly commit myself to the struggle to free Leonard and all the other political prisoners in particular, and to try to build a defense for Jamil Al-Amin, who now is on trial for his life in Atlanta, where they're trying to set him up.
You're talking about, well, formerly known as H.R.A.P. Brown.
Yes.
You've also been active in support of Mumia Abu-Jamal, is that right?
Oh, yes. I participated in the prisoners' art show that toured internationally for him, and I hope to really be active in the lesbian community, mobilizing women to support political prisoners and to work closely with other activists in this community.
In terms of education in prison, in sort of formal schooling, you got a degree while you were behind bars.
Yes, I did.
A master's?
I finished my bachelor's degree, which I was a dropout in 1967, but I was able to do so because I did get some scholarships, and at that time there were Pell Grants, and which have since been discontinued. When I was doing my bachelor's degree, there were over 100 women who were participating in a college program at FCI Dublin. When the Pell Grants stopped, all those women were unable to finish their own schooling, and it was a program that people really enjoyed and really benefited from. And I know there's all kind of studies that say that anybody with any kind of education beyond a GED has almost a 0% chance of returning to prison. So I think it's part of the plot to expand the prison population that they took the Pell Grants away.
You mentioned KPFA and Democracy Now! And Pacifica Radio overall. What about the times you were in jail, in prison, without alternative media, independent media, and the times that you were with? Just what did you gain by independent media, by Pacifica, by KPFA?
Well, as you know, there is very little news of what's going on around the world on the mainstream media. And that is one of the most important aspects, I think, of my own political development, is being an internationalist and really learning from the struggles in other countries and trying to figure out how we can link up. So I did subscribe to some magazines from other countries, including Third World Resurgence, which is published by an NGO out of Malaysia. And I depended on my comrades for information. I got lots of flyers and newspaper clippings.
What are your plans today?
Today?
Put away the groceries,
yeah. I'm hoping to get some training in computer skills. You know, they have no access to the internet inside. I'm hoping to learn how to stop turning off cell phones with my smile. I'm really trying. trying to just take it slow and get my feet under me, because it's very disorienting to come out of prison so quickly. And then I hope to hit the ground running and start working for my comrades.
As I said, we had your sister activist, Susan Rosenberg, on the air last week, and we had hoped we could have you on together, but you can't speak to each other?
We're not allowed to speak to each other or to any of our co-defendants who have been out for much longer than us, nor to any other released political prisoners or ex-felons.
For how long?
I'm not real sure. My own parole is scheduled to end in 2011. That seems like a real long time right now, but I have, you know, the typical restrictions of anyone in California, which means that I'm able to travel quite a long distance up and down the coast, so that will help me a lot. It's quite different to be able to go stand in a redwood forest after being locked up for 16 years. But I can't help but be conscious that they're trying to cut them all down. So it's a very mixed blessing.
What is the rationale for not being able to speak with other people who were convicted of the same charges you were?
I assume that the rationale is that they are fearful that we will engage in criminal activity. That's certainly what they would say. I think that it's a restriction that applies to everyone that's on parole, so it is not particular to us. I think it's a bad restriction because people who are released from prison really need a support group that can understand what the immensity of the changes are. So I know it would help me to be able to talk to some of my comrades who have been outside and have learned to function in a world that has CD players and talking cars and cell phones.
You were an activist in Austin, Texas, where, well, the new president, George Bush, has been located as governor. What are your thoughts about that? Also, going into prison under the Reagan-Bush administration and now coming out under the Bush-Cheney administration.
Well, I think it was really ironic that we were released on the day that he was inaugurated. I feel like it's I don't know. I have a mission to try to build some resistance to his policies, which seem to be the same as his father's, if not worse. And he certainly seems to have a lot of people in his cabinet that served under his father. It seems like a dynasty to me, you know? It's Bush the second.
I wanted to ask your attorney, Debbie Katz. I mean, here you were in prison for 16 years, and attorneys who take on these kinds of cases, what role did you see yourself playing through the time, or were you there from the beginning?
I've been Linda's lawyer since about 1989, and I have seen my role at different steps depending on what she was facing as giving her a voice and giving her the best representation she could have to oppose whatever the state was doing to her at the time, whether it was when she was on trial in D.C., they had erected a plexiglass wall and put surveillance cameras on people who came to the well of the courtroom. That was my first involvement with Linda, where we filed a motion that I think was captioned, shut the cameras and take down the wall. That was the first struggle with their case, and since then, you know, at every step of the way to try to bring the injustice of her situation to the attention of the public and to put the parole board and the pardon board on notice that we were going to continue to fight and that she was not going to be buried in prison. And I think that's really the vital role of political lawyers for political prisoners, is to just make it clear to the government that we will not allow our clients to be buried in prison and they're going to have a voice.
Plus, she has to take us grocery shopping after we get out.
You've probably heard about the controversy around Mark Rich, the billionaire fugitive from Switzerland who didn't serve a day in jail, involved with a tax scheme, an illegal tax scheme. Linda Sue Evans, have you heard about this, the pardon that President Clinton issued? I guess his ex-wife, Denise Rich, has given more than $1 million to the Democratic Party, has visited President Clinton more than 100 times in the last year, has visited the Clintons. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I can't say it surprises me that he bought a pardon. I think the same same thing happened with Dan Rostenkowski and others. I don't know anything particular about the Rich case.
I can say that in this situation, I really do feel that Linda got a real meaningful look by the pardon counsel in the White House administration. I assure you there were no political payoffs in this case. So I think that, you know, her situation really spoke to someone who paid attention to it, and the same with Susan Rosenberg. I mean, their situation was so inequitable and so outrageous, but clearly there seems to be some real corruption in the pardon process.
Debbie Katz, you're the attorney for Linda Evans. Can you go through the statistics again and what the average is sentence given to a person who was charged with what Linda was charged with, giving a false name and getting weapons and being involved in a conspiracy to bomb a Capitol building?
In the national averages for someone who is convicted of buying legal guns using a false ID, most people in the country would just get probation. They'd never do a day of jail time. For those who were sentenced nationally, the largest sentence that we came up with was under 2 years. So Linda being sentenced to 40 years for this offense, it was just simply outrageous. It could not be justified by anything other than her politics. And in fact, at the time she was sentenced, the judge made clear he was aware of the national sentencing data because that's something that's brought to the judge's attention. But he made clear that because of her revolutionary politics, he felt that she was dangerous and needed to be put away for a very long time. And that's what he said, in deviating from any kind of rational sentencing guidelines. Same thing with the parole board. When she went up before the parole board, and the even with this long sentence, there are guidelines that say how long she should have to serve before being given parole. And her guideline was 52 months for these offenses. And the parole examiner essentially said that you have desecrated one of the sacred institutions of our democracy, and we're not letting you out, even though you've been a model prisoner. So those two factors going forward, which were the grossly disproportionate sentence and the fact that the parole board was not going to let her out for clearly political reasons, really just, it was egregious. And I think that the president took that into consideration.
Why do you think the judge turned around?
Well, you know, he really did look at what Linda's record has been like inside prison. I think that his view of her at the time was she was very talented, intelligent but wildly misguided young woman. You know, he put those kind of comments on the record. And then he looked at what her track record had been in prison, which has been very impressive. Every time the institution has let her do anything, she has really done very good work. And Judge Feldman looked at that, and I think he was really taken with the fact that she had been serious about her continuing her social commitment and working toward social justice in the prison. Her basic character had not changed, but he understood that her view of what she would do upon release had changed dramatically, and I think he felt that she was ready to be released.
And that does it for today's program. Linda Sue Evans had her sentence commuted to time served by President Clinton in the last hours of his presidency. Debbie Katz was her attorney. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Our engineer is Anthony Sloan. Special thanks to Robert Knight. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Fired and the Band, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!